Association, and I guess Jacob Littler is the first spokesman. Do you want to come up as a panel or come up one at a time? We have David Atar Saheli, Anna Wegman, and Scott Formo. You're going to do a PowerPoint?
We'll go one at a time individually.
Fine. Just as long as you introduce yourselves.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members for convening these hearings and allowing the students the opportunity to come and present the information that we have.
And please know that, anytime we meet, if you ever would like to comment on what we're doing and be on the agenda, just feel free to call us or even let us know during the hearing. You can always pass a note to Ms. Shively over here.
Thank you. As you said with the agenda, my name is Jacob Littler. I'm currently enrolled full-time at Mesabi Range Community and Technical College in Virginia, Minnesota. I serve on the Campus Student Association there, as well as serving on the Phi Theta Kappa Committee, which is the International Honor Society of two-year colleges. I'm entering this semester. I came in just 22 credits short of finishing my transfer curriculum, and it's my hope to move on to one of the universities in the MinSCU system and complete my bachelor degree and then hopefully move on master's work and doctoral level, because I would like to eventually teach on a collegiate level. It's always been an ambition of mine to continue my education. For as long as I can remember, I knew that I would be going on to college. Ultimately, I'd like to receive my doctoral degree, as I said, and work in the field of education or perhaps even run for office. And I believe that these attitudes stem from the way that I was raised. My mother raised my brother and myself on her own. And therefore, she had to delay her own education for many years. And because of this, she really instilled in us a deep respect and a desire to continue our education and really to better ourselves in a way that she wasn't able to for many years. And you can imagine then the frustration that I felt when I graduated from high school and I found that my family would be unable to support my educational goals, that the cost would have to be absorbed by myself. During my high school years, I had moved back up here to Minnesota to live with my father, and shortly after I graduated from high school, he was laid off from LTV Steel Mining, and he was therefore unable really to contribute to my education. In addition to this, the financial aid system really left me with very few options because of the way that they calculate the expected family contribution. For students under the age of 24, everything goes off of your parents' income, and unfortunately it was the income from the year before he had been laid off. So it's kind of a way that that the higher education and financial aid systems really don't benefit the middle class, because you have a situation where my family made too much money on paper to qualify for financial aid for myself, but they really didn't have the funds available to support me, so I was pretty much in that gap area and left out. In spite of these obstacles, I did decide to try to make an attempt at college right out of high school. Between a full load of classes and working two part-time jobs, and probably a certain level of immaturity as well, I just wasn't able to carry that. This put me in the position of having to enter the workforce with nothing more than my high school diploma and a desire to work. I worked a series of low-wage jobs trying to save up the money to get back into college while trying also to pay all the new bills and expenses that I was presented with after moving out of my father's house. For 6 years, I continued a cycle of low-wage jobs that just barely covered the bills that I had. And I'd check back at the college occasionally, try to register for classes. I'd fill out the financial aid forms, and I would always be denied because, for whatever reason, my father had to tap into his 401k and didn't qualify for a hardship grant. Just certain situations like that where that would count as income against my financial aid. And since all the money that I was making was really just going to cover bills and I wasn't really getting ahead at all, I didn't see it as a possibility to try to add college tuition and classes into that mix. Finally, at the age of 24, I was considered an independent student according to the federal financial aid guidelines, and I was able to apply for financial aid on the merits of my own income. Armed with a full package of grants, loans, and scholarships, I came back into higher education. And frankly, I was shocked by what I found. I re-registered at Mesabi Range 6 years after my original attempt, and when I first went in 99-2000, it was around $70 a credit. When I re-enrolled last year, it was $130 a credit. This year, due to the increases, it's gone up to $141 a credit. When you add on all of the fees, the books, the supplies, traveling back and forth to school, it's a huge amount of money that I'm paying out in order to get this education that I don't think anybody disputes the fact that we need in today's society, that we need this education. In fact, the amount that I'm paying now is so much that despite the full financial aid package that I'm receiving, I'm still forced to take out student loans. And I've even been forced to put books and supplies on credit cards because of there's delays written into the financial aid process. They always wait 9 days before they'll give you the financial aid check. Well, 9 days in class without a book isn't really feasible. So out comes a credit card, buy the book, and wait for the financial aid to come to pay it off. In this combination, you know, it's going to leave me with a lot of debt when I graduate. For years, I'll be paying off my student loans. And I'm in college now because I do want to better my position in society. And I wish I could have had the advantage of completing my undergraduate education right out of high school so I could be well on my way towards achieving the goals that I've set for myself. And I want to work in higher education because I've seen the impact that a great educator and a great administrator can have on a student and what they can do to focus you and really help you find the goals that you have in your life. And also the same idea with possibly looking at legislative work, because you as lawmakers are in an incredible position to affect society in a great way, and I would love to have an impact like that someday. And just something to kind of put all of it in perspective, and I share this with the House Higher Ed Committee as well. When Representative Tony Sertich was my age, 25, he had graduated from college, had been elected to his first term in the state legislature. I'll be 28 before I can finish my undergraduate degree. And with tuition climbing at the rate that it has been, I don't even know how much debt I'll have when I graduate. And, you know, it comes down to, you know how much a legislator makes. So imagine making hundreds of dollars in loan payments on that salary. And that's what I'm looking at when I graduate. And all I would ask is that the members would keep in mind my story and my goals as you decide how to fund higher education. These decisions do affect generations of students and future Minnesota workers. And if there's any questions, I would be willing to answer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Littner. When you first applied for college, you said your father had just been laid off,
yes,
but that they looked at his income from the year before. Wasn't it at that point that you needed to apply for, what did you call it, the hardship provision?
Well, that was for his 401k. There are independent student rules written into the financial aid system.
Or even mitigating family circumstances, because you're right, family circumstances can change from year to year.
Absolutely, and those rules are written in, but unfortunately, I wasn't very knowledgeable on the financial aid system, and the financial aid office at our college was overwhelmed with students that were looking for financial aid and filling out applications. And it was before kind of FAFSA on the web was really big, so everything was done through the financial aid office. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a good amount of it did just amount to a lack of knowledge on my part about how I could have gone about a process like that.
But you're right, also to try to make the financial aid offices more user-friendly so that students don't get discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right, students get kind of a sticker shock. And if they don't know that what financial aid is available, or you can just be over the cutoff, and especially a hardship on independent students. I agree. It's, you know, it's just very difficult to figure that out when you're truly an independent student and when your parents just aren't, you know, living up to their responsibility,
mm-hmm.
Which we think they should, because out of choice, not out of that they can't.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, and another thing that was incredibly frustrating, as I said, was when I did finally come back to see the amount that tuition had increased, mm-hmm. and what had been passed on to students. It's very frustrating to go back and see that I'm paying $141 a credit for what should be, you would think, a lower cost education at a community college. You know, the idea being I'm going to stay in my community, I'm going to go for the first couple years and save some money so that when I go to university, maybe I can have some money saved up. But it doesn't work that way anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Tomassoni.
And if I understood you right, you get a full financial aid package and you're still having to take out loans. And
absolutely.
So that's an indication of that the financial aid packages aren't even good enough to cover the cost of college now. And that somewhere along the way here, I don't know how we reversed the trend, and we talked about this before, but it'll probably take several years to reverse the trend if we act accordingly. But right now it's the students are in a bad way because they're coming out of college with a mortgage, they don't own a house, and they don't have a job. So I can see where people are going to be paying their college loans off to the point where they'll be paying their college loan and their kids are going to start going to college. They're going to have to start taking out more loans for their kids because 20 years down the road, you're still going to be paying your college loans and doing whatever else. So somewhere along the way, we got to get a handle on this.
Senator Tomasoni and members, in the governor's proposal, I believe it's like $92 million for what he calls the Achieve 2 proposal. Senator Roebling is carrying it. So, you know, I mean, we can make a decision if that money is part of our target to, you know, use it to hold on tuition, to use it for inflation at MinSCU, to use it for financial aid. I mean, those are the hard choices we have to make because we should do all of those things, all three of those things. And I don't know if we'll have enough money to do all those things. Hopefully we'll have decent money. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
So next is David Atarsaheli. Did I do it?
Close enough.
Now say it again.
It's Atarsaheli.
I was close. Atarsaheli.
It's been 24 years of that last name.
Finnish? What is it?
It's Persian.
Persian. Oh, great. Welcome from St. Cloud.
Thank you. Good afternoon to everybody. That's why you're here. I'm David Atarsaheli. I'm a sales and management student at the St. Cloud Technical College. I'm here today to describe three things. One, how rising tuition rates have affected me. How the underutilization of technology is becoming a burden at my college. And finally, how being a student with a non-traditional student with a disability is becoming a greater challenge due to budget cuts and program changes. As you all know, tuition in Minnesota has risen 102% over the last 10 years. Like Jacob Littler, who spoke before me, I had the pleasure of attending college when I first unlike Jacob Littler, I had the pleasure of attending college after I graduated. But like his family, mine is a middle-income family. But I took the burden of student loans to begin with, which my parents actually had to pay for because they wanted to buy a house shortly after I tried college the first time. And that was a burden left on them, which I am still ashamed of for the fact that my education cost them money because I'm a very independent person and don't like to cause financial hardships on people that I don't really have to, especially when they paid for me the first 18 years of my life. But now I have matured and grown, and I do take out student loans to cover the cost of textbooks and some living expenses because I do have a job that pays me well enough to where I don't need to work more than about 25 to 30 hours a week, which is amazing because I know students, fellow friends of mine actually, who work upwards of 80 hours a week, two full-time jobs and a full course load to support themselves and their children, which means they're C students.
No sleep.
That's where the C student comes in. They're not at class. They're dealing with family stuff. It's a waste of their time and taxpayers' money to have a higher tuition rate where students can't afford to go to school and spend almost all of their time focused on their final goals and getting out of college faster. The technology aspect of the St. Cloud Technical College is a majority of our computers and classrooms are greatly outdated. The workforce uses technology that's up-to-date, current, and as good as possible. And I understand, and my fellow students understand, that the cost of upkeeping these computers at that level would be enormous. But it's also unacceptable in the fact that the technology lags so far behind what's currently out there that we're being taught programs that are, for the most part, archaic or on computers that are so old that half your class time is used just waiting for it to boot up and run so you don't get the full use of your course load or course time. One aspect of this would be D2L, the Desire to Learn system. When the system came out, it was funded by MinSCU, but it was hard for teachers to upload and know the programming. Now that they know how to use the program, it's become outdated to the fact that the time it takes to upload content and to fully utilize the system is a detriment in itself, which could be fixed by creating bigger servers, better teaching styles, all that sort of thing. Finally, as I said, I'm a non-traditional student. I also suffer from mild ADD, and I'm slightly bipolar, which can be fun at times. The biggest problem with that is my ability to take notes. I'm a horrible note taker, and I know this, but there's programs available on my campus that will help me overcome this. That help me overcome this dilemma. Unfortunately, due to budget cuts, the number of people available to help has been greatly reduced, while the number of students who need the services has increased. I had the pleasure of being a peer tutor last year at my college, and I worked one-on-one with students who had very similar issues as I did, who didn't know that there was help out there, who couldn't get the assistance. And once I showed them how to do it and where to go, they not only received their first A's in class, but they liked school again. They wanted to finish faster. They started taking greater course loads. Instead of the minimum 12 credits, they were taking 15 to 20, which means they cut out a whole semester of cost and joined the workforce faster, thus contributing back to the state of Minnesota at a greater rate, which I thought was amazing. But the way things are going now, it's harder for students to do that, not only because of the cost and the work needed, but because the systems aren't in place to help promote that sort of thing anymore. In closing, I'd just like to thank you and remind you that education is the cornerstone of Minnesota's growth, both socially and economically. And without reinvestment and rededication, our state will no longer be as great as it is now. And it's your job as leaders to remember that not only fixing today's problems, but planning for tomorrow's is also a great issue. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tarsa Haley. I wanted to ask you, and I wanted to ask Mr. Littler, where you went to high school.
I attended St. John's Preparatory School for 3 years, which was a private Catholic school in Collegeville, Minnesota, which was part of the reason my parents couldn't really help foot the bill for my college. They spent all their money on my high school.
Wow.
And then I graduated from Sartell High School.
From Sartell?
Sartell.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And where is Jacob? Where did you go to high school?
Most of it in Colorado, but I graduated from Babbitt.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Any questions? All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Anna Wegman from Fond du Lac. And where did you go to high school?
I actually graduated from ESCO High School. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share my story with you. Like you heard, my name is Anna Wagman, and I'm a full-time student at Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College in Cloquet. Tuition has affected me greatly in my choice of career. When I first began my education, I was in the Human Services Program. My goal when I finished my degree was to move into the field of Child Protective Services. With all the problems right now that my community is facing with meth addiction, I felt I could really make a difference helping the lives of the affected families. Unfortunately, when I started looking into what an average social service employee of the state makes each year, I knew I had to change my goal. I'm one of many students who receives no financial aid besides student loans. I work 30 hours a week, and I take a full course load besides being involved in my school. But I'm still forced to take out loans to pay tuition and some living costs. By the time I complete my four-year degree, I'm going to have around $20,000 in debt. And with starting wages being around $9 for people in social services, I knew that the stability of my financial future depended on me changing my career choice. Without the program change, I couldn't even ensure that I would be able to make my student loan payments. As a result of high tuition and debt, I abandoned my interest in social work, and I have moved into the field of biology. There are a lot of incentives given to students who can manage the hard course load in a science field. Although I really care deeply about the environment and learning about ways to protect it, I see children and families in my community that are hurting, and I feel like high tuition costs really drove me away from being able to help them. I know it was my choice to change programs, and maybe I should have stayed in human services, but in a real way, tuition kept me from doing that. I couldn't continue in the human services field knowing that the rest of my life was going to be a struggle for me. I would probably never own a house or a car that was reliable anyway, and I would never be able to send my own children to college. Even though child protection workers are essential to Minnesota, 4 to 6 years of college should not equate to barely scraping by in life. this isn't just my story. There are many students who are like me. Tuition in Minnesota is driving people away from the roles that Minnesotans desperately need filled. These roles that require passionate and educated workers, like social workers and teachers, policemen. Workers whose passion can overcome the meager wages, but not when it's combined with heavy educational loan burden. These rising tuition costs are not only hurting students and their families, but they're hurting entire communities and our state as a whole. I would urge you today to commit to the vitality of Minnesota by stopping the skyrocketing tuition and student debt. Funding the requests of the system keeps higher education strong, and freezing tuition keeps the future workforce both educated and responsive to the needs of business and communities. Thank you all for your time. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wagman. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Ms. Wagman, was Fond du Lac your first choice, or would you have preferred to have gone somewhere else?
No, actually, I had looked into quite a few different colleges, but my family is one of those that just creep over the line where you get help, but there's no way that they could ever afford to support me in any way going through college.
So you were unable to go to the places you really wanted to go to because of the
cost?
Yeah. Okay. Because, Madam Chair, I know there was a UCLA study about that one particular thing, and that up to as many as one-third of the students that are looking to go to college can't go to their first choice because of the tuition problem and unable to afford it. So you're at least one out of three. Do we have three out of three here? Huh? Three out of three. none of these were able to go to their first choice because of...
And career choice.
Huh?
First choice college?
First choice college, yeah,
choice
as
college.
A result of tuition. So they've all opted for something other than their first choice of college because of the cost.
Yep. Well, yeah. My daughter, too. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Formo, Mr. President. Sounds good, though, doesn't it?
I am starting to get used to the title.
Yeah.
Put in your packets as a copy of the PowerPoint presentation itself, too, if you want to follow along there.
Master.
Good afternoon, Chair Pappas and committee members. My name is Scott Formo, and I'm a third-year legal and business student at Alexandria Technical College, and also the current president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, which represents over 100,000 students from the two-year public technical and community colleges here in Minnesota. I, too, have a personal story which relates a lot to what the three previous speakers have talked about, but today I'm going to focus on my role as president representing the state, representing all of the students from the two-year public community and technical colleges. I'd like to start out basically, first of all, by going through the current stance at the Minnesota State College Student Association. We support three areas this year. One is a fully funded 2008-2009 Minscu biennial budget request. The second is a fully funded two-year tuition freeze. And then third, increasing the Minscu capital budget request to fund the remaining priorities of 2006. I have included a copy of the 2006 priorities on goldenrod sheets that has been passed out to you also, which details the priorities, which of those were funded, and the remaining priorities for you to review and reference. As you can see from this chart, Minscu educates nearly twice as many students as the University of Minnesota, private colleges, and private career schools combined, totaling 64% of public education for undergraduates in Minnesota. Many of the critical service roles of the state's graduates from our two-year technical and community colleges, such as law enforcement officers, construction workers, mechanics, nurses, teachers, business professionals, firefighters, and first responders, are currently filled by the needs of Minscu. The investment that the state of Minnesota makes into Minscu pays off in state revenue dollars at a rate of $10.87 for every dollar spent by the state. Minnesota does currently have a statutory obligation to fund 67% or two-thirds of the total cost of instruction at Minnesota public colleges and universities in an effort to keep public education an affordable option for everybody in the state. That does leave a third of the cost of the responsibility to the students and their families, but as you've heard through other testimony, and actually leading into this next PowerPoint too, over the last few years, the state's commitment to the two-thirds, one-third model has declined and currently is at the rate of the state providing 51% of the education and the students bearing 49% of that. MSCSA is urging lawmakers to set a goal of returning to the state's 67% commitment to funding higher education. Average tuition for a full-time student at the two-year public colleges in Minnesota. This chart here is showing three different areas. The blue line at the top is the average tuition. The pink and the yellow lines are the adjusted tuition rates, the pink being adjusted for the consumer price index and the yellow being adjusted for the higher education price index, which is just a little bit higher than the average or than the consumer price index. As you can see, back in 1987, just 20 years ago, they were all three at the same point. Slowly over time, they started creeping and separating a little bit. But as you can see, starting in fiscal year 2002 and 2003, the average tuition in our two-year public community and technical colleges really took a jump and is well above the inflationary increases that we've seen over the past 20 years. In 2003, Minsky's state appropriation was cut by $191 million. Of that $191 million cut, students made up 91% of it, or $173.6 million, during fiscal year 2004 and 2005 in increased tuition. I thought they did more internal cutting than that. Currently, Minnesota is ranked as number two in the nation with regard to tuition and fees as being second highest in the nation because of these tuition increases. Those are statistics that are taken from the Chronicle of Higher Education. As tuition, fees, textbooks, and the cost.
Mr. Formo, just on that last slide, sure. And maybe we can find this out too, but I'd be interested in knowing the one right before in the national ranking, is if any of these colleges that are kind of close to us, Vermont, West Virginia, New York, and, you know, right below them, if they're planning on raising their tuition, we have any...
I don't know the answer to that, but I could certainly look into that and find out for you and see what I can find out.
Okay, I just wanted to be able to find that, too.
And one thing I forgot to point out, too, is we did have another handout there, which that slide just shows the top five in the nation, but we did pass out where all 50 states do rank in the nation, so you have that chart available, so it just didn't quite all fit onto the PowerPoint.
Yeah. Or needs to be free.
As tuition, fees, textbooks, and the cost of living has increased, student borrowing has also increased, which you've heard through other testimony. According to a recent report titled Student Debt and Consumer Spending in the Minneapolis-St. Paul Area, between 1993 and 2004, the cost of living in Minneapolis and St. Paul has increased by 35%. Health costs in the metro area, including insurance, drugs, and medical care, has increased by 52%. However, the average student debt rate has increased by over 107% during that same decade, or during that same time frame. As you can see, student debt has increased at a much faster rate than other costs in the area. When it comes to Minnesota's changing demographics, as you can see from this chart, back in 1970, the blue line at the top is our K-12 educational pipeline, and the pink line at the bottom is going to be the aging workforce of basically being 65 or over. As you can see, back in 1970, there was a great deal more students coming out of the K-12 system and moving into higher education than there were people nearing the retirement age. As we're nearing the 2010 and even gearing up for 2020, those numbers are going to be increasing as our baby boomers are retiring. However, the students coming out of the K-12 pipeline is not necessarily increasing. In fact, recently that number has been decreased. Basically, what this is going to show is that Minnesota and the nation are going to demand more college graduates and more highly skilled workers within the next decade to take the place of the retiring baby boomers. You've already heard from MNSCU what their request entails. Now I'd like to walk you through how that compares to the governor's proposal, and then finally how that compares to what we as students are proposing to you also. The highlights of this slide is basically going to talk about two new initiatives that the governor has proposed in the student aid arena. One is in veterans benefits in the amount of $30 million for the Minnesota GI Bill. And the other one is the high school to college transition. He actually has two different proposals out there, one of them in higher education, which Chair Pappas has already commented on earlier, with $92 million going to the Achieve 2 program. But he also has a proposal out there in the K-12 bill for another $75 million for his 3R high schools, which is the rigor, relevance, and results, which that program is supposed to provide access to a broad range of college credit opportunities and require that every student complete a full year of college while still in high school. The total proposal from the governor for the high school to college transition encompasses $167 million being dedicated specifically to high school graduates through those two programs. This one here kind of lays out in detail exactly what the governor's proposal is, which you have already seen those numbers also. And I'm just going to highlight two areas that the governor, other than these two areas, for the most part, he's matched dollar for dollar the MNSCU request. Other than the recruitment and retention of underserved and underrepresented students, he's proposed $12 million, which is half of the MNSCU request. And the technology infrastructure, his proposal has $60 million, which is $10 million short of the MNSCU request. So the total amount proposed by the governor is $123 million. The student request actually entails $275 million. $250 million of that is new funding, because MNSCU already has $25 million built into their request in reallocated funds. What's missing from the governor's proposal that the students are seeking? The $73 million for a funded two-year tuition freeze, $57 million for funding inflation, $10 million for upgrades and investments in technology and infrastructure, and the remaining $12 million for the recruitment and retention of underserved or underrepresented students. That total comes to $127 million, which is, if you add up these numbers, it's $152 million, but when you take out the $25 million in reallocated funds that MNSCU already has built in, it equals $127 million and short of the governor's proposal. One question that we've been asked a lot of is, how do we make up that $127 million in funding for MNSCU and, more importantly, the students without raising taxes? Well, basically, the students would suggest that you support the governor's proposal with three simple adjustments, which Chair Pappas already talked about one of these earlier. One, we would recommend that you redirect the $92 million from Achieve 2 to fund the two-year tuition freeze at $73 million. To put the additional $10 million into the investments in the technology and the infrastructure upgrade. And the remainder of that $92 million, $9 million of that could be redirected to the recruitment and retention of the underserved and underrepresented students, which would only leave $3 million of that request unfunded. Redirecting the $25 million performance bonus to partially fund inflation, which, as you remember from the previous slide, was $57 million according to the total MNSCU request. That would leave $32 million of the request left to be funded. And then provide the remaining $10 million from other resources. As we were working as students on our Get Out the Vote campaigns earlier this fall, we heard a lot of lawmakers talking about higher education being a priority and some of the other initiatives that are out there to come up with other types of resources to help fund higher education. One of those that kind of sticks out in my mind comes from former gubernatorial candidate Mike Hatch's proposal to close the corporate tax loophole. I mean, there were a number of those different ideas that were out there that lawmakers had proposed for coming up with additional funding. Our proposal here kind of brings it back down to where we could totally fund the MNSCU system and the tuition freeze, and there's only $10 million gap there if this were the route that we were looking to go. Some of the highlights from here, just to point out, is that the Achieve 2 and the governor's 3R high school initiatives, we do feel that they're steps in the right direction, as we definitely want to be supportive of the K-12 system and that transition from high school to college. But at the same point in time, is it really important to have two different proposals totaling $167 million being targeted towards the same group of students? According to the Minsky publication, Amazing Facts, the average Minsky student is 26.3. I would encourage you as lawmakers to dig deeper into the governor's proposal to help the high school to college transition be the best that it can be, but then dedicate the other money to helping the remainder of the students and everyone else in the state, especially the average Minsky student. Minnesota's public two-year college or public colleges are meant to be the affordable open access point for all people that wish to pursue a higher education. As you've already heard, too, public education is a very important investment, one that the state has had a long tradition of committing to the funding. Minnesota and the nation are going to be demanding more college graduates as the baby boomers are retiring. The need for affordable public higher education now is greater than it ever has been, and we urge you to provide the state with the affordable, accessible, and quality public higher educational system that Minsky has been set up to be. Once again, just to go through what our association is asking is that you fully fund the 2008-2009 Minsky biennial budget request, two, that you fully fund the two-year tuition freeze, and three, increase in the Minsky capital budget request funding the remaining priorities from 2006. Funding a two-year tuition freeze is going to do three things as far as we're concerned. It's going to benefit students of all ages, backgrounds, and income levels pursuing a public education. It's going to give students a break on the rising cost of tuition without hindering the strategic initiatives and advancements of Minsky and the Minsky Board of Trustees. And three, it's going to meet the needs of the Minsky system, college and university administrators, faculty, and students alike, which we see as a win-win situation for everybody. And with that, I would like to thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Formo. That was excellent and really very informative, a lot of good information, and I thought it was very thoughtful in terms of how you suggest we put it all together. So thank you. I appreciate it. We're going to move on because we have, like, a really full agenda. But thanks. Minnesota State University Student Association, starting with Justin McMartin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for inviting us here today. I am Justin McMartin, the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I also attend school at Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall, Minnesota.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school in Lewiston, Minnesota. I don't know if anybody knows where that is.
No, but, it's interesting.
11 miles west of Winona. And what we're going to talk about today is, well, first of all, I'd like to mention that our association holds very similar stance to what Scott had just got done speaking about, and he's done a very good job illustrating where things are and that there is money for higher education out there. And we hope that you can help us find maybe even a little more to cover the rest of those areas. We're going to have several of our students give personal testimony stories to begin with here. So I'm going to invite Rick to speak about his story and how he's and his struggles that he's had in his higher education.
Why don't you start out by introducing yourself and telling us where you went to high school?
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rick Houghton, and I went to high school in Cannon Falls, Minnesota. And now I serve as the vice chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I'm also a student at Winona State University, where I'm a senior. Like many other middle-class families, my family was not able to save thousands of dollars to send me or my younger sister, who will be graduating from high school this May, also in Cannon Falls, to send her to college. As a first-generation college student, tuition costs were not something that my family had made plans for in the beginning. I've had to take out loans to cover every year of my college career. This will be my fourth year, and I will have one more semester of loans yet after this year is over. That means I will have a total of 4.5 years in student loans to cover everything from tuition, fees, books, residence hall expenses for 3 years, and rent for 2 years, and other living expenses. So far, I have borrowed $48,000. $36,500 of that is in private loans, which are accruing interest very rapidly. I already have more than $2,800 in interest on my private loans. Looking ahead, I'm very concerned about how I will be able to repay these loans. Looking back the other day, I started to wonder where could $48,000 in loans go over the last 4 years. So I did some calculations. I've spent approximately $21,500 in tuition over the last 4 years. Winona State University implemented a mandatory laptop program a number of years ago, which contributed to the $5,400 in fees that I've paid. In addition, I lived in a residence hall for 3 years, which cost a total of $8,700 for room and board. I also paid $320 in rent at an apartment that I share with two other students this year, which totals up to about $3,800. Finally, I pay an average of $500 per semester on textbooks for a total of $4,000 over 4 years. That means just to pay for tuition, fees, textbooks, and a place to live, I spend $43,400. That leaves me with $1,130 a year, or about $96 a month, for any other expenses I might have. I've been working 20 hours a week this year, but it's still very difficult to make ends meet. As MSUSA's vice chair, I am here not to just tell my own story about how student loan debt and high tuition have impacted me, but also to represent the thousands of other students attending our state universities who cannot be here with us today. The students I represent are starting a new semester. Some may be looking forward to graduating. Many may be back next year to continue their education. All of them, however, are looking for relief from large tuition increases and the growing student debt, and they are counting on you for help. Please support funding for MNSCU at a level that will freeze tuition for the next 4 years. I thank you. And I'll take any questions you may have.
Mr. Howden, did you explore getting self loans?
I believe the only loans that I were available to me were the federal unsubsidized loans through the FAFSA program. Otherwise, I don't know what a self loan would entail.
Madam Chair, and members, with the self loan program, something that is often a reason why students don't go that route, and why I myself didn't go that route, is because you are forced to pay the interest rates while you're in school. And if you don't have the money to pay those interest rates, going the private route often is a better situation, because that interest just accrues over the lifetime while you're in school, and you don't have to make, I think it's twice a year, payments on the interest for the self loan. And so that's an often a reason why students don't go the self loan rate or route.
Well, maybe we should talk to the Office of Higher Education a little bit more about that, how the self loans work and why they work that way. Mm-hmm. So put that on your list. Thanks. Great. Any questions for Rick? Mr. Howden? Thank you very much. Then Jennifer Oren?
If it's all right, I'll take the opportunity to speak kind of about our situation.
Fine.
Now, as far as where we're at. As you know, we're all here today to talk about the cost of higher education. And at our state universities, the cost of our tuition has risen 70% over the last 5 years. When cuts were made to public higher education, as Scott addressed in his presentation, $191 million of that cut came from the MNSCU system, and $73 million of that went to our students in tuition increases. Those tuition increases have had a significant impact on our students' lives. Many have worked more hours, some to the detriment of their grades and academic success. Some took fewer classes to lessen the financial impact, which meant that they would only extend their graduation date and ultimately pay more in tuition because of more tuition increases. Some students even dropped out of school completely, hoping to earn money before returning. Many, however, have increased the amount of money they are borrowing in student loans. In fact, there was a 48% increase in the amount of students attending state universities borrowing between 2001 and 2005. Students graduating from our state universities in 2005 graduated with an average of $18,500 in loan debt. At least half of our graduates have debt. At Southwest Minnesota State University alone, 83% of the 2005 graduates had student debt. Even though I've worked 25 hours to 30 hours per week at the Southwest Marketing Advisory Center in Marshall, I have still had to borrow $33,000 in loans for my education, including $14,000 in private loans. While I know that my education is valuable, I am very concerned that I will have a difficulty paying these loans back. And like most of the students I represent, I also worry about whether I'll be able to get a job that will allow me to pay these back as quickly as I would like. We are working to combat this problem at a variety of different levels. We work with administration on our campuses to increase to keep increases in tuition down. We've been meeting with state senators and representatives to talk about the need to fund public higher education. And we're even working at the federal level to cut interest rates and make it easier for students to pay back their debt. Students are here today asking for your help. An investment in public higher education is an investment in the future of Minnesota. I know that the governor's budget includes money for new initiatives for our system, but not funding for inflation. Inflationary dollars are absolutely critical to the access and quality of our colleges and universities. Just as inflation impacts our own personal costs, it also impacts our schools. There's an increased cost each year to do all of the things that our campuses are already doing. And as Scott mentioned, you know, 91% of our, or all the percentages of all those people in Minnesota who are coming and staying and work, going to our schools and staying in Minnesota and working and contributing to Minnesota, we're already doing those things now, and we need to keep covering those costs. Students are asking for the system to be funded at a level that will freeze tuition at current levels for over the next 2 years. Additional funding will help maintain those high-quality education programs that are offered at our state colleges and universities. For many years, the benefits of having a well-funded education system have been recognized by the people of Minnesota and many legislators, but there seems to be a disconnect between that recognition and the legislative decisions that have been made over the last several years. During many campaigns, higher education costs were a frequent topic, with many candidates promising to stop the rising cost of tuition. When the ballots were cast last fall, voters sent that message that higher education was a priority. There's no better time than here and now to show that Minnesota's commitment to higher education, to deliver on those past promises made during the campaigns, to buck that trend that we're making in Minnesota and nationwide, that that higher education is not something that should be funded in this way. You heard from several students today about the cost of their education and how it surpassed their ability in many ways to pay for it. And those who follow me will also speak to that. They will tell you that the price of tuition is simply out of reach for themselves and their families without taking out large loans. They will tell you about making decisions about their future path in life based on the debt that they owe today. So I hope that their stories will help illustrate the urgencies that's required in this situation. The students that we have lined up will also provide a vivid picture of the situations that many other students in the system are facing. So at this point, I'd like to thank you and then allow them the opportunity to come up and talk. And I'd field any questions if you had any as well.
Okay. Why don't you bring up the students?
Jennifer.
So this is Jennifer Oren.
Yeah, this will be Jennifer.
Right, great.
Madam Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Oren, and I'm a student at Minnesota State University, Moorhead. I'm an early elementary education major and a psychology major. I'm married with two children, and my husband is a fireman. I'm going to school and working towards a degree in hopes that someday I will be able to contribute to my family's income. However, I'm becoming more and more concerned about the sacrifices made by my family and by me to pay for my education. Textbooks alone cost me $600 this semester. In addition, we pay for daycare for our children while I'm at school and while he's at work, which is very expensive. So far, I have $13,000 in student loans, but I'm estimating that I will borrow about $32,000 before I'm done. Even with two incomes, this amount will be very difficult to repay. I want to become a teacher to help others, but a $32,000 debt on a teacher's salary is very daunting. In addition, we hope to start saving for our children's education, which will be very difficult while repaying my own student debt. This is especially true now. My husband is in the National Guard and was deployed last month to Iraq, which basically leaves me as a single mom dealing with everything and trying to make everything work. Unfortunately, there are many stories like mine. Across the state, there are students trying to get an education and raise children. Like mine, they are struggling to pay for childcare and balance their family's current needs with their family's future. You can make a difference. Cheaper tuition means fewer student loans. I want a better education to help better my family. I just wish it was a little easier.
And how old are your children?
Two and three.
Two
boys.
And what high school did you go to?
West Fargo High.
Say it again.
West Fargo.
Okay. Great. Sorry about your husband.
Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah. Any questions? Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Oren, thank you for sharing your testimony. You were one of the first that pointed out the high cost of textbooks and a lot of the discussion on tuition, but you still pay real dollars. I think students are getting gouged. And I have asked in the past, have had legislation to look at a textbook rental program, and it doesn't seem like anything ever comes forward. We need to study it, and I think there's another study coming forward. Has the Morehead campus looked at this issue? Are you aware?
One thing that our Student Senate has been working towards is a buy-sell trade website that we hope to have up and running by the end of this semester so that it can kind of, so students can sell their books, you know, to other students and hopefully cut costs that way. So.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
I know that there's also a bill moving on VA benefits for veterans and their dependents. And I'm wondering, I don't know if anybody in here is a co-author on that or knows anything about it, but I'm wondering if they do mean spouses, that they would be eligible for tuition aid through that bill. Dennis is nodding.
He's nodding. Is that coming to our committee?
Okay. Well, that'll be interesting to hear because that's something that could help you out in your situation, perhaps.
Thank you very much. Now we have Carrie Winter. Just tell us your name and where you went to high school.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Carrie Winter. I went to high school at Galena High School in Illinois. I'm currently a student at Winona State University and majoring in political science and public administration. When I graduate this May, I will have taken out $40,567.64 to fund my education. This is really frustrating for me because I feel as if I've done everything right. In high school, I wasn't able to save up very much money because I was always actively involved with school activities, like being the editor of the school newspaper and drama club, National Honor Society, on the soccer team, and the golf team. I had a job in high school as a teller at a bank and at a few restaurants and at a ski resort, but still had very little saved. I've applied for several scholarships every year I've been in college, but the only one I've ever got was the Penny Fellowship Scholarship to help pay for an internship I had with Senator Durbin in D.C. I wasn't even qualified for quite a few of the scholarships because I don't qualify for financial aid. My parents owned a small towing and welding business until they sold it last summer. However, the business and the land the business was on counts against me because those things are counted as assets. However, my parents still don't have enough money to help me pay for college, so I'm paying for it completely on my own. A big part of my college search had to do with the price of colleges, which is why I picked WSU 4 years ago. Although I am from Illinois, I get in-state tuition because of an academic scholarship I got through school. I tore the ACL in my knee 12 days before I came to college, so I was on crutches for a while. Then, over winter break that year, I had surgery on my knee, so I came back on crutches again and wasn't able to get a job because of that. Over the summer, I worked at a golf course a lot, and during my sophomore year, I worked at Kmart and was on the Student Senate, where I currently serve as the vice president. I did a 2-week Native American travel study in the Dakotas, but otherwise I've never done travel study or study abroad, which I really would like to do, but I literally cannot afford it. It's frustrating because I feel like I've done everything the way my parents, my professors, and older friends have told me to. I've always been actively involved on campus, kept up my grades. I'm graduating in 4 years, always had a job when I could, and I'm still graduating with over $40,000 in debt. I just want to get a good job when I graduate, doing something that I love. Even that scares me because the places I'd like to work, such as at a feminist organization that fights domestic abuse, really don't pay that high. I'm very worried because that I'm going to spend too long paying off these loans and end up paying a lot in interest. By funding our schools, you can help keep tuition and student debt down. I hope my story, as well as the others you've heard today, help you understand the problems of student debt and high tuition. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Senator Weaker.
Madam Chair, could I just pose a question to any of the students before we go to the next
sure.
section? And Madam Chair, it has to do with the millions of dollars that are spent by students, their parents, and also by the state of Minnesota to address remedial credits, where you don't earn credit, just put you in a position to take math or other English courses. That's out-of-pocket money as well. It's not the fault of the higher education, but any thoughts on the remedial programs that are needed now, or suggestions as to how the system works at this point?
Anybody?
Madam Chair, Senator Wicker, that's something that actually we've been discussing. And as far as when we participated in MinSCU's process of creating their budget this year as to what to come to the legislature with and request, those were discussions that have started to happen as far as a system of P through 16 in school as to how we can make it more seamless so those courses. And I think that is an interesting question that we probably don't have as much information on as we probably should, and that's something that we'll do more looking into as far as maybe get you some more information about how those work now. I never had to participate in any of those, so but yeah, it's an interesting question.
I think remedial is more an issue for the 2 years, don't you think, Senator Wicker?
It's Madam Chair, I believe it's more of an issue there, but it is also for the other institutions and even the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It does have some that would require that.
We could all use a little math brush up. Speak for yourself. thank you both very much. Excellent.
You have to approach.
Would you like to come forward then and speak in the microphone? Introduce yourself.
That big thing. My name's Joshua Sturman. I went to high school just in Forest Lake, so it's been a while. I graduated in 94. And I've just been going to was Lakewood, and now it's Century College. And just in regards to the credit transferability and some of that, I was just looking right now at I went about 3-4 years like in the mid-90s, and then I got, I started my own business, got involved in other things. Oh, and on the good side, I don't owe any money. That's when I don't have my degree yet, but just since everybody else has been so far in debt. With the graduate studies, I was looking at going on, the difference between the bachelor's degrees or master's, some of those, and there are a lot of even the higher level courses that won't necessarily transfer over. So just for the suggestions, I was hoping to set up some of the individualized, there's a variety of different programs within the different colleges that will allow for like life credits and those things. But it ultimately, my ideal resolve out of it would just be to work on the employment placement, at the end, if you guys, or for just doing, like coming down here, I could come down here and for the political sciences, that was one of the other things I was looking at, and if there would be a way of just being credited for the time spent here as, like a life credit, it'd be an easy way to just cancel out the whole thing. Anyway, I didn't really have anything prepared, so I don't want to take up too much
okay.
of this time.
Well, thank you very much for your comments.
Chair Pappas, if you could allow for one more question, or do you need to move forward?
Of who?
Of the student. It could be Justin McMartin or
Mr. McMartin.
Jacob McLitterer. Littler. My question is in regard to the credits that need to be taken because of not being able to enter into be prepared to enter into college level work. Mm-hmm. Have you in any of your analysis determined how much of the costs, expanding costs for higher education, are associated with students having to add to their costs because of this problem?
I don't have any of the research on that, okay. Senator Sharon, and that's something that I think we'll be looking into more details.
So the question is, how much is added to the cost of education when you have mm-hmm. to take non-credit remedial courses?
Yes. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question was, what we're looking at is the impact of the cost of education on the students and on their future ability to be able to move forward in their lives. And the question here is about what is the state's responsibility as opposed to the students' responsibility and the ratio of responsibility. And so one of the questions is, what are the drivers for the cost of your education? Is one of the, how much is the need for remedial education contributing to the problem that students are having?
Yeah, I mean, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the
McMartin.
The remedial courses that are taught on our campuses are charged the same amount as rates of tuition. So, I mean, it is a significant cost if they're in some case you're found to not have the level of math to participate in whatever math courses or especially in your English courses. I think where a lot of it is where those additional remedial courses are. And it is a significant cost. And I think that's something that we're going to go back and do some more research about. And the faculty might actually maybe even have some information about that as well.
Senator Sharon, I think we can get that from administration is, you know, which campuses, what percentage of the students are taking remedial courses, how many they're taking. I think there have been, that's why I meant there are studies on that.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The University of Minnesota and Minsky submit a report every other year on remedial courses that are taken, the types of courses, and the number of students that are taking those.
So Ms. Weidman can dig that out for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew.
Let's
Thank
move
you.
On to the so faculty. Again, you have a question for students? Just a comment?
It's related to the comment that was made before that they would like to take the Achieve $2 and roll it into the inflationary costs for the Minsky system. Oh, okay. And I just wanted to ask them, when we're talking about remedial education, I believe that the Achieve 2 program is kind of designed to address part of that, to help prepare students better for college, and so that they wouldn't necessarily have to take those courses at the college level, but that we would be addressing those issues more in high school. And so I just want to keep that in mind as we move through here, because that could be a savings for students down the road if they're coming into the system better prepared. And we know a third of the students in the Minsky system are taking remedial courses. So I believe that that is an issue that we have to keep in mind, as preparation ahead of time will be a savings to individual students later.
Okay, you don't have to respond to that, but if you have something else to add.
May I? I just would like to say that that is something that is definitely should be kept in mind and is something that's of interest to our student associations. But we also need to keep in mind that there's, 4 years of school of students and 2 years of students who are in our institutions right now that kind of a program doesn't benefit. And these are the students who have shouldered significant burdens over the last several years. And so that's something else to keep in mind as well. But
okay,
so thank you
very much. Sorry, I need to move on. Minnesota State College faculty, Greg Mulcahy. Thank you all for coming and testifying, and some of you traveled quite a ways, and we really appreciate it. The weather's nice.
Good afternoon, Madam
Welcome.
Chair, members of the committee. I'm Greg Mulcahy. I'm the treasurer of the Minnesota State College faculty, the two-year faculty unit. I'd like to commend the students on the excellent presentations they've given here today, and they have spared me from repeating a lot of numbers, so I'm very happy about that. I want to talk a little bit about faculty and faculty's role here. My colleague Joanne Roach testified in the House, and one of the things she did that I think is worth mentioning here is give a little bit of history in that faculty in the two-year colleges have been through the merger that created Minsky, the development of the transfer curriculum to address transfer issues, and semester conversion, along with other initiatives that have come out of the system through the years. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of these initiatives. The faculty participated in them. The faculty made them successful to the extent the faculty could. But part of our concern as faculty is that oftentimes when people talk about higher ed in this state and nationwide, their priorities become technology or some kind of innovation or some kind of bold initiative. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. However, there's a core mission here, and it seems to me when you're talking about an institution, you should talk about its core mission and what it does. The fact is, through good times and bad, the college and university faculties have been teaching students in the classroom and online, and sometimes that seems to be devalued. It's as though that's just kind of a given and everything else is an add-on. We are in agreement with the two-year students, basically, in terms of the dollars. We'd like to see the Minscu amount fully funded. We'd like to see the $73 million for the no new tuition. In terms of how you find it, we'll be happy however you find it. We don't have a real firm proposal there. We think it's essential that Minnesota get back to seeing public higher education as a public good and not a private good. And we think it's frankly naive to see it in any other way. In terms of the technology money in the Minscu proposal, we're supportive of technology money, but we would ask you, when you have Minscu here, to please try and get a commitment from them that this technology money will go to technology for student learning and not to create any more bureaucracy. We want the technology that'll allow our students to succeed first and foremost. I've talked to your committee before about compensation and bargaining. Right now, our faculty are between the 40th and 50th percentile in salaries when compared to like institutions. I know that my colleagues from IFO are going to have a lot more to say about this, so I'll kind of leave that there. The other thing we would urge you is we'd like to see money come with few line items. We think that kind of allows for better bargaining, and it also may insulate from some line item vetoes. So having said that, I'd also say I'm a graduate of St. Paul Central.
I have three daughters who graduated from St. Paul Central. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Mulcahy? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
IFO, Interfaculty Association. I thought it was organization, IFO. Is that right?
Yeah, interfaculty.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Ms. Myers and Mr. Stanton.
Chair Pappas and Senators, it's a pleasure to be here and participate as a citizen in this exercise. I clearly appreciate this opportunity and also to hear the group of students before us, because that's who we're here for. I am Sonia Myers, an associate professor who teaches nursing students in the undergraduate and graduate programs at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Greetings from them. I have been a nurse for 30 years. And I've, for the last 15 years, I've been in teaching practice at MSU. I have come to understand that teaching and learning in nursing is complex in an ever-changing environment with ever-changing students and all of their needs and challenges. Nursing faculty have experience and expertise for coaching students in essential nursing judgment skills for accompanying patients in their health experiences across the lifespan. All graduates must be good. The health of our state depends on it. As nursing faculty, we are committed to excellence in outcomes in the form of our graduates and the care they provide. Excellent outcomes are supported as we implement new teaching strategies, design innovative and practice relevant curriculum, provide leadership and service to the university and the community, advise developing professionals, and contribute to nursing science. At MSU, we currently have 300 pre-nursing students, 300 active undergraduate students, and 60 enrolled graduate students. Of these, 31 are in a fast-track accelerated option second degree program. 40 are associate degree graduates who come to us for their baccalaureate degree to increase their clinical judgment skill set. And our graduate students are enrolled in our primarily online graduate program, often commuting from a 150-mile radius, to prepare as nurse educators, family nurse practitioners, and clinical nurse specialists. Our most current curricular innovation is going through the approval process for a new Doctor of Nursing Practice degree as a consortium of schools between us, Minnesota State University Moorhead, Metropolitan State University, and Winona State University. These graduates will be the innovators of the future, translating the best of science to the best of practice across our state. The opportunity to offer the applied doctorate was granted through the Higher Education Bill in the 2005 legislative session. We have responded to the nursing shortage by increasing the number of students admitted, expanding new programs. However, we, as faculty, are at our limit. To increase our graduate numbers, we need more nursing faculty. At MSU, We have 33 full-time faculty positions to accomplish the work with these students. We now have only 17 full-time faculty members, 11 of whom hold doctoral degrees. The remaining positions are being filled by part-time and adjunct baccalaureate and master's degree nurses. These nurses are excellent and highly skilled clinical nurses, often from our partner clinical settings. However, they often lack the expertise to effectively coach students with these complex changing times. Our faculty is a showcase of the national trend in the shortage of full-time nursing faculty. In the 2005-2006 academic year, we had 8 positions open for full-time faculty. We filled 1. Why are we unable to fill those full-time positions? The answer is complex. First, demographically, of course, more nurse educators are retiring than joining the academic ranks. Well, why? Why would that be? It seems like a good job. One reason may be that nurses aren't choosing to become educators. It's the cost of doctoral education nationwide, and those who go on for a doctorate and are potentially nursing faculty members graduate with large debt. Add to this the fact that salary competition from the service sector is intense. In a recent survey of our own graduates, we discovered that the average salary for a baccalaureate graduate after 1 year of experience is $49,000. The average salary for a nurse practitioner, master's graduate, is in specialty care is $74,000. The starting salary for a master's prepared assistant professor in nursing is $40,000 to $45,000. Nurse educators live this unfortunate paradox. That is, more education may lead to less salary. Realize that we understand that these are living wages, and I'm particularly conscious of that in light of the students' testimony before us. These are living wages. They are simply not competitive wages. We are also in a highly aggressive academic recruiting environment. For instance, we lost out on hiring a faculty member 2 years ago because she instead accepted a position in Vermont where the legislature offered her $10,000 in student loan forgiveness, the school offered her a competitive salary, and they also paid relocation expenses. We were able to match the salary but not the other two parts of the package. She liked us but not the rest of the package. Currently, we are recruiting for 9 open positions. Our budget allows market-matching competitive salaries for 1 or 2. In addition to recruitment issues, we are facing increasing retention issues because our current faculty members are being actively and regularly recruited. Our productivity has been stellar. Our product is excellent, and it is time for a Minnesota reinvestment in the labor that has made our programs what they are today. We respectfully request consideration for the following to once again make our system a first-choice place for innovative teaching, research, and service, not only for nursing faculty, but for all faculty. First, to support the 3.5% inflation adjustment. Second, to support the $26 million appropriation for a nationally competitive salary schedule. Third, to support a $94 million appropriation that will expand high-demand areas such as nursing, but exercise caution with any funding request to promote increasing the number of nursing graduates without specific reality-based benchmarks that increase numbers of qualified nursing faculty. And finally, consider partnering with other committees, perhaps, on creating a faculty loan forgiveness program. We thank you for your continued support of nursing education and all education in the state colleges and universities. We urge you to support the health of Minnesota citizens through supporting faculty who are teaching the leaders of tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, when you said you had the ability to offer higher wages to a couple of your staff that you hope to hire, is that because that's all your budget has, or is there some limitation in the bargaining units that don't allow too many of you to go above the rest of the faculty on the campus.
Actually, there are no limits in the bargaining agreement. What the limit is the budget. And we've really been very successful in the last couple years trying to raise the amount. I mean, what we're raising is the salary to recruit people onto our campuses. But we only have so much of a budget to do that. So, you know, we have 8 positions, but we really, in reality, that's the positions for the work. But we have 2 positions if we... with competitive salaries. And we really are on a national market. It's in the 10 years that I've been more conscious of these hiring practices and attending national conferences, it's very aggressive and it's very national. And because the nursing faculty shortage is very national, so thus the result. So,
is the Minsku Allied Health Curriculum development, that's something different. That's not really addressing the nursing educator problem.
Right. It's. I think it's related. I see it as related. And how I see it related is in the innovative teaching practices where perhaps partnering in those kinds of things with other institutions, supporting simulation labs and those kinds of things will expand our access to clinical types of experiences. And so that's one prong of why we can't increase more enrollment is the whole idea of limited clinical space. Mm-hmm. But the other piece is limited faculty. So,
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, Ms. Myers, you mentioned 2 salaries that you said were living wages but weren't competitive. One was $49,000, the other one was $74,000, I think. What would they have to go to in order to be competitive?
The living wage I'm talking about, the wage that I am stating here about starting faculty salary is $40,000 to $45,000. And to be competitive?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know.
To be competitive, I probably we're competing with those master's people that are getting $74,000. So $60,000 to $70,000 to be competitive and on a national ranking, not only with the service sector but with the academics.
So are we in the ballparks?
No.
So that's why you end up hiring part-time adjunct.
Correct.
Maybe retired from nursing and are just teaching part-time.
Or working part-time working part-time in the service sector. And I'm very respectful of their contributions. We simply could not do nursing education in the state of Minnesota without them. So while we certainly value their contribution and really enjoy that partnership, it leaves us lacking in a lot of areas.
And how long does it take for a nurse to get a doctorate? You'd have to...
Start with a master's. Mm-hmm. And 5 to 8 years seems to be about the normal time for a PhD.
Okay.
And I'm from Battle Lake High School. And Winona State and the University of Minnesota.
Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair. Dr. Myers, you mentioned something that I'd like you to expand on a little bit, and that was that when you're talking about allocations, that you want specific benchmarks when it relates to increasing numbers of students. Would you be more specific about what it is that you're guiding us to be looking for in those proposals?
Dr. Myers.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Chair Pappas. What I'm speaking specifically to is that in the last several years, we've had many what I call fenced money initiatives to expand programs, and we've done that. We've increased programs. We've increased numbers of students, but we really have not increased the numbers of faculty. So I would like to see if there's any expansion of programming that's going to occur that comes with a matching salary line or salary amount for faculty to be considered. Does that make anything clearer? We really are at the point where we've expanded as much as we can with the current staffing quality.
I don't know if this is a question for Dr. Myers or for Mr. Stanton or maybe it's for Minsku administration. But if we increase inflation or compensation or some, you know, kind of broad category. Does that trickle down to help in recruiting nursing teachers? It's kind of asking the wall.
So you're asking if...
Yeah, I mean, is this a... Do we need to do a kind of a targeted thing here with a multi-pronged approach, you know, loan forgiveness, you know, additional compensation for nurse educators, you know, the things that you're kind of competing on,
mm-hmm.
you know, or if we do a broad brush where we, you know, we kind of fund inflation, which translates into compensation.
Right.
Does that help? Does it trickle down to you?
I think the broad brush response, my broad brush response is to do an across-the-board increase, to increase the base and increase supporting the inflation factor helps immensely
mm-hmm.
with our ability to then bargain. And, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of nursing faculty. However, we couldn't do our jobs without the chemistry faculty. So across the board will be helpful in that respect. And then I feel confident that within our own universities, we can make those negotiations happen mm-hmm. if we have the funding to deal with at the time of statewide negotiations.
Okay, great. Thanks. Mr. Stanton.
Thank you. Chair Pappas, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm director of the government relations for the Interfaculty Organization. For people who are new to the committee, the Interfaculty Organization represents about 3,200 full and part-time faculty at the seven state universities. We also have faculty in Rochester at the center there. And I'm here today to express the views of the faculty in general on the Minsky budget request and also the governor's proposals. Our number one priority in terms of funding of higher education is funding the inflation request. The last time that Minsky has had an inflation adjustment was in 2001. Since that time, because of the lack of inflation, we've had a serious erosion of our funding base. There's a pink sheet here that I handed out in a packet, and if you look, it's the actual appropriations and tuition collected over the years by the Minsky institutions. Back in 2002, the state appropriation to Minsky was $601 million. 4 years later, in fiscal year 2006, the state appropriation to Minsky was $600 million, $1 million less. Even though during those 4 years we had inflation of close to 12%, during those 4 years we added 8,005 FYE new students. That's the equivalent of a very good-sized state university. That $600 million buys a lot less today than it bought 4 or 5 years ago. What have been the effects of not recognizing inflation? First of all, because the state didn't fund its share of inflation over the last few years, it just simply got pushed over onto the students, and it resulted in skyrocketing tuition. Again, if you look at this sheet, it shows the percentage in columns 5 and 6, the percentage of the operating costs of Minsky institutions over the years that were paid by students through tuition versus state appropriations. And if you go back to the early 1980s, the state paid 80% of the cost of running the institutions. Students paid 20%. Then in the 1990s, we went to the one-third, two-thirds. In fact, that's actually in statute, still in statute, that the state would pay 67% of the cost and the students one-third of the cost. And that was pretty much the pattern up until fiscal year 2002, and then things took a very bad turn for the worse. Since 2002, the state share fell from about 66.3% of the cost of operating the institutions down to 52% in 2006 and about 50% this year, although we're still not through the year, so I can't say exactly what the tuition collections will be. As a result of that shifting, tuition shot up. In just 4 years, student tuition at the state universities, that same 4 years, shot up 54%. And as you heard from the students, that's driving them deep in debt, and it's forcing many of them to work long hours and stretch out their completion times. Everyone, you know, I've sat at these committee meetings for years and years and years. Everyone gives lip service to access, but I can tell you in the last 4 or 5 years, access to higher education by working class students, and that's exactly who attends Minsky institutions, has become much, much more difficult. The Minsky request calls for a 3.5% inflation adjustment each year. We, of course, support that. However, the Minsky request calls for the students to pay $73 million of that inflation and the state to pay 57% of that inflation. And while that's better than no inflation adjustment at all, it still continues the process of shifting an ever-increasing amount of the inflation burden onto the students. And the faculty believe that the state should pay all of the inflation costs this time, the $73 million plus the $57 million, because, frankly, after so many years of not paying inflation, we think it's the state's turn. If inflation was picked up through appropriations, a two-year tuition freeze would be possible for the students, and we think that would be a good idea. Competitive salaries, the second big issue related to not recognized inflation, has to do with the competitiveness of faculty salaries at state universities. State universities, as Sonia mentioned earlier, compete nationally for faculty. 20 years ago, faculty salaries at state universities ranked in the 80th percentile nationally. What that meant was when they went out to recruit faculty, they could get the best and brightest faculty. They kind of had their pick of the market. This year, according to AAUP study, the same study, the state university faculty salaries are below average at every single rank. They're between the 40th and the 50th percentile. In fact, that I believe it's the associate rank, we're below the 40th percentile now in faculty salaries. And what this means is that the state universities find themselves in the unenviable position of hiring from a market pool that's 50% picked over by better-paying institutions. It's harder to recruit faculty. 1 in 5 faculty searches fail at the state universities nowadays. As Sonia pointed out, some good examples of the difficulty in hiring nursing faculty. I staffed a joint administrative faculty task force a couple years ago on faculty compensation. And I can tell you that the same stories exist at every institution, and they exist in many fields, not just nursing, but in the areas of finance, in the areas of accounting, IT, et cetera. What we need to come to grips with as a state is that the same market forces apply whether you're recruiting professional athletes or hiring chancellors or hiring faculty. The employer that pays the most gets the first pick. And we're not in a good position in that market. Also, you need to realize that when we lose faculty, usually the faculty member that leaves is the best faculty member. And the reason is they have the best and most marketable credentials, and they're most sought after by other people. And it's a classic case of adverse selection that occurs. My point isn't that the faculty are poor. Our faculty tend to love their jobs, but they're doing it at a great financial sacrifice. My point is that it's a quality issue, and there's very few things that impact the quality of learning in our universities than the quality of the faculty member who's teaching the courses.
Mr. Stanton, do we have any numbers as to when we lose faculty, if we tend to lose them to other public universities or to private universities?
I couldn't tell you for sure because we don't do exits. I can tell you that private universities 20 years ago when I came were significantly behind public universities in terms of their salaries, and they've just shot by us in terms of faculty salaries. They're way ahead of us now in terms of faculty salaries.
Pardon me? I've just saw a chart, so I think they're ahead of Minsky, but I think they're still behind the U.
Yes. When I do these comparisons, we're not comparing ourselves to institutions like the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They're a whole different category. We're comparing ourselves to Category 2A institutions, which are what most of our state universities are. The governor did call for funding many of Minsky's initiatives, and we appreciate that, even though a lot of it is one-time money. But it's our view that before you launch into a lot of new initiatives, that you pay attention to the base funding of the system and keep it up with inflation. Maybe there are, I mean, we're not saying that the base shouldn't be on the table. Maybe there are things in the base that you want to cut and reallocate the money to something more important that you feel is more important. But we can't just keep ignoring the base like we have been for quite some time now. And the reason is because the base is what funds the $3,500 or more academic programs we currently have. And those programs are the ones that produce 32,000 graduates a year that, you know, supply over half the teachers, 80% of the nurses, 92% of the law enforcement officers, 42% of the business graduates. Not only do these programs give students an opportunity to enter careers that they'd like to be in and give them much more earning power over their lifetime, but they're absolutely essential for the functioning of our economy and our society. And maintaining the quality of those existing programs is just as important as starting new ones. Even though inflation, the governor recommended inflation in most areas of the budget, of course he did not recommend inflation for higher education, and we're hoping that the legislature will. Two last points. I passed out a couple of charts in the packet. The first is this white chart from Governing Magazine. Governing Magazine, as many of you know, is a magazine for state and local government officials. You can find it over in your legislative library. And each year they do a comparisons of how states compare in various areas. And one of the areas they compared is higher education funding. If you look in 2002, which is the first of the two white pages, Minnesota ranked 20th among the 50 states in terms of higher education funding per capita, the amount of money per capita. They rank far lower when it comes to effort when you take into account our incomes. This year, this last issue that was published last summer, we slipped to 30th. We're behind Mississippi and Alabama in per capita funding of higher education in Minnesota. Also, I've distributed something that I got last week in the mail, the post-secondary opportunity newsletter, which shows the state tax appropriations for higher education by state. It's a measurement of effort, sort of like the price of government measurement. And what you'll find if you browse through that is that while all states have seen a decline in the last couple decades of the amount of support or effort for higher education, Minnesota has had one of the most precipitous declines. We our effort is less than half of what it was back in the late 70s, for instance. Minnesota is a cold state. We're not centrally located. We're a fairly high-tax state. We have been in the past. Yet our economy has continued to grow by leaps and bounds. It's the faculty's point of view that the reason that has occurred is because we've invested very heavily in higher education in the past. Our plea to you today is that you can, that this generation do what previous generations did and invest in higher education. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Stanton?
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomassoni.
This thing here is all about per $1,000 of personal income, and so, well, it gives you some pretty good indications of where it goes based on income. I'm not exactly sure what it tells us, but what this one here that the students handed out that talk about the actual tuition, is this a direct indication of state support, or is it a combination of state support and...
I'm not familiar with that chart. Okay. I'm sorry. The students could probably answer that.
This is the two-year students, yeah. Right. The reason I ask is because this $1,000 of personal income, I think, can give you a whole slew of information.
depending upon how you apply it and how the, what the taxing systems are and how the and so I don't, I'm not exactly sure what the interpretation should be.
But I think that the interpretation of it is that is effort. In terms of our wealth, how much, what percent of our wealth do we put into higher education? I don't think, I mean, because we're wealthier, you know, our dollars per thousand are probably smaller, but because we're a wealthier state. I think the more meaningful comparison is this one from Governing Magazine, which is per capita, because they show it both per capita and as a percentage of wealth. And on a per capita basis, we're just not the state that we used to be.
Yeah, and the obvious conclusion is we haven't kept up.
Yes, and who's paying the price are the students.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, when we talk about higher education spending, as they are indicating here, does it include all of the money we spend, including the grant program, the tuition aid program that we have?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, yes. It's everything. U of M, MinSCU, Office of Higher Education, all of those programs together.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Stanton, I was just thinking about maybe the responsibility of the state is to, you know, kind of the base to fund inflation, significant, you know, investments for everyone like technology. And then through their internal process, MinSCU should use reallocation to fund new initiatives because, you know, I had a hard time. You know, I don't know if there are any administrators in the room here, but I really felt like I had a hard time getting enough. I got some, but enough information on how decisions are made on reallocation, how you phase out programs that are no longer relevant, you know, to today's student or today's consumer, in order and use that process as a way of then shifting resources into some of the new initiatives that are more relevant to today's student and the marketplace.
I think that's a very good way of approaching it. Keep the base so that it has the same purchasing power, and let them decide what programs, if they want to start something new, what they want to shut down to start something new.
And they should that should be an ongoing process because, you know, we're always needing things change so rapidly in the marketplace. And, I mean, they did talk about, like, especially with the 4 years, it's like turning an oar boat. I just got a note that I'm not being critical if no one is here from MinSCU because they're in the house right now. And that's, we meet at the same time, I guess. So they're, you know, that's fine. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, thank you for your time.
Then our last item on the agenda is Jane Olson from St. Cloud is going to talk representing the administrative and service faculty.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and distinguished senators. We're the group of people, I think, that many of you don't know at state universities. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'm going to work hard. I have official testimony because I am representing nearly 600 administrative and service faculty from the state, but I also don't want to repeat myself. And what other people have said, but I probably will. So I apologize in advance.
Well, you know how you, the best way to learn is repetition. So.
Good. More than three times. I think you'll hear many of the things more than three times. Members of our bargaining unit represent many functions within higher education offices, and that includes admissions, registration, residential life, health services, campus recreation, financial aid, student activities, and various multicultural centers. We are enthusiastic about the role that we play in the development of our future leaders. Of course, and following on the heels of faculty, teaching faculty, we acknowledge that much learning takes place in the classroom. But in addition to traditional classroom learning, many significant developmental changes occur based on a student's experience outside of the classroom. And I think many of you heard the examples of the students who spoke before us that talked about what we would call the parallel curriculum, being involved in student government, various associations, the Political Science Association, etc. I need to quit my ad-lib speaking. ASF members play myriad roles on campus to facilitate this professional and personal growth of students. Our overall goal is to continue to develop students' skills to be successful contributors to the state of Minnesota and the global economy. Members of our unit not only serve students, but also other administrators, instructional faculty, parents, alumni, and employers. As a group, we would like to offer the following thoughts regarding the future of higher education in the state of Minnesota. In general, we support the Chancellor's biennial budget proposal. Since the Minnesota State Colleges and University System provides 64% of the state's resident education, we believe that it is important to continue to fund and really even to increase our commitment to quality education within this system. And I'd like to comment on five particular areas. And you've heard a lot about the concept of inflation, and I'm going to repeat here. Number one is infrastructure. We are troubled by the lack of inflation being represented in the governor's recommendation for the Minsky budget. Inflation increases are vital for maintaining a high level of both academic and quality services in the educational experience of our students. Not accounting for the reality of inflation results in a decrease in services and programs that ultimately would facilitate the success of our students. Without significant commitments to addressing this issue, we will lose ground in providing the quality that the state of Minnesota has prided itself in for many years. Technology is the second issue. The request of $70 million for technology is a necessary commitment for the purpose of upgrading a struggling technological system. Again, a repeat of what some of the students said. Many of the essential functions of the integrated student record system have not kept pace with the technological advancements. Consequently, the track record of the information technology department and equipment within the system has been inadequate in meeting the needs of specific campuses. We believe that one of the strengths of the Minsky system is the ability for institutions to meet each student's unique needs, which obviously vary from institution to institution. It is the hope of ASF members that this substantial increase in technology funding would meet two essential goals. First, it would support the system's need to collect system-wide data for comprehensive data analysis purposes. But second, it would allow individual campuses to design design data collection systems that meet the unique needs of each campus. The past experience of many of the state university's offices has not been positive during the initial rollout phases of our information technology systems. So given this experience, we support this technology funding request, and we are cautiously optimistic that the overhauling of the system will better address the needs of each campus. Tuition, you're going to hear something that I would call non-decisive here. In the year 2000, you've heard before that the appropriation to support students attending Minsky institutions was 67%. The support has eroded. We're very alarmed about that. And 7 years later, the number is 51%. It's created great concern about whether there is a demonstrated support for the important investment of higher education for the future of both of our citizens and the state of Minnesota. We would recommend that our governing officials closely examine the need to continue to invest in a public good, and I heard that spoke about before, that will pay dividends for years to come. We are keenly aware of the students' interest in a 0% increase in tuition over the next 2 years, and we also know that the Board of Trustees has requested a 4% increase over the next 2 years. The difference between these two positions is in the neighborhood of $73 million, And I guess our position is, obviously, given the current rate of inflation and expected increases, it will be difficult, if not impossible, to meet those needs without additional resources to provide a quality educational experience for our students and, of course, for the good of our communities. And it's a very difficult question, and we are not taking a formal position on where that money would come from. And I'm hoping you all have the answer for that. This has been spoken about, too, and it's the changing student profile. In the future, many traditional age college students will represent currently underrepresented groups, including students of color, individuals from low-income families, and first-generation college students. These populations of new students are critical to both higher education and the state of Minnesota's future in general. As a legislature and a system, we applaud and encourage the allocation of resources to offer equal educational opportunities to all students in order to help change people's lives and to promote healthier communities. And finally, I want to briefly talk about the collective bargaining agreement. And we would like to say that investing in the administration, faculty, and staff in the collective bargaining process is crucial to maintaining a healthy educational system. Our goal should be to provide the highest quality services, instruction, and administrative leadership to our students. Through fair and reasonable contract settlements, we will be able to maintain and attract the caliber of individuals that can best facilitate the professional and personal development of our students. Without adequate support, we may continue to erode a system that has for many years been held in high esteem nationally. In closing, members of the Administrative and Service Faculty Unit in MinSCU take great pride in the role that we play to facilitate the success of and more positive futures for the students in Minnesota. Student success is a cornerstone for building an educational system in which to take pride. Three key ingredients to a successful higher education experience are academics, student life, and financing. You have, as legislative leaders, an opportunity to impact all three of these key factors. We applaud the work that you've done and will do to enhance the future of higher education in Minnesota. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Olson? Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else here in the room who would like to testify? Anything they'd like to add?
Total these numbers to